This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
There is big trouble at both poles. From Korea, scientist Malte Stucker explains why the Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the world, disrupting weather over the Northern Hemisphere. Then veteran Antarctic scientist Richard Levy tells about the double threat driving Antarctic ice into the sea to flood coastlines around the world. But first,
we are old climate veterans who have tried to do our part in every way we know how to keep our fossil fuel addicted civilization from driving off a cliff. Are we tired? Sure. Discouraged? Absolutely. Sad? Call it brokenhearted. Are we quitting?
It might be time. Game over, friends and experts tell us. We're doomed. It's true that the news about global warming is awful. More and bigger wildfires, great swathes of drought, stronger and wetter hurricanes, floods of all kinds, feedback loops kicking in, refugees looking for safety as weather turns cruel. Destructive ways of living are skillfully protected by tangles of profit and power around the globe, and we are running out of time. The IPCC now gives the world just over a decade to cut global greenhouse gas emissions in half if we are to stop warming at only 1.5 degrees Celsius. Don't think quitting hasn't crossed our minds.
Last month, on the way from one meeting to another, we stopped along the coast to watch a red sun set through purple clouds. While parents gathered up their families, children lingered ankle-deep in pink water looking out to sea. A flock of gulls flew north. Why do we keep doing this climate work? We asked each other. Maybe to our surprise, answers to the question flooded out one reason after another.
Because we are not doomed as long as we act. A world in which we do everything we can to restrain climate change barely resembles one in which we do nothing. We won't like the first world, but we might not survive in the second.
Because I want to be the kind of person who doesn't give up on important jobs. You don't do what's right because you think it might get you something. You do it because it's right. That's what integrity is, doing what you believe in, even if it won't save the world.
Because I won't walk away from the hurting world any more than I will walk away from my mother as she grows old and frail and sometimes confused. I love her and owe her and have a duty to her and admire her and enjoy her company.
Because I promised my newborn children, I will always love you. I will keep you safe. I will give you the world. I didn't mean I will give you whatever is left, scattered and torn on the table after the great cosmic going out of business sale. I said, I will give you this beautiful, life-sustaining, bird-graced world.
Because everybody knows what we have to do. It isn't as though the world is waiting for some technological breakthrough or divine revelation. We just need to stop setting carbon on fire.
Because climate change is unjust. It threatens the greatest violation of human rights the world has ever seen. But injustice is cowardly and fragile. It crumbles when people stand up for what is right.
Because we have so much to lose and so much left to save. Everything from birdsong to our own sorry souls.
Because we don't want to be free riders taking advantage of the actions, often sacrifices, of those who step up. If we avoid planetary ruin, if we find better ways to live, it will be because of the courage of those who act.
Because failing to act is worse than neutral. It's saying that this climate disruption is no big deal, exactly the message fossil fuel corporations and complicit governments want to convey. If we don't respond to the emergency, we become part of the storm itself.
Because I am wearing my dad's rubber boots. They're too big for me, but my own are old and torn. So I'm walking in the boots he wore at the edge of all the marshes he defended until the day he died. If you're walking in the shoes of your hero, you can't exactly turn back.
Because I can't, and therefore don't have to solve the whole problem alone. I only have to help where and how I can. So many good people are in this fight with us, in governments around the world, in businesses, in states and towns and neighborhoods and churches. They are smart and experienced and empowered by a vision of a planet redeemed.
Because I believe and choose to believe that in this emergency, as in every emergency, more of us will come out to help each other than will rush in to exploit and loot.
Because despair is lonely and useless, while climate action is full of friendship, satisfaction, and glee. You get to hang out with people who care as much as you do and act with the same remorseless resolve. Taking action is the only real cure for hopelessness. It feels good and important, like you're not wasting your life on small things.
We sat on a beach log, mulling over our reasons to stay in the fight until the stars came out and the breeze came up. Then we walked back to the car on a mossy trail through a tunnel of spruce trees. A Swainson's thrush sang and would not stop singing, even in the deepest dusk. And that also was a reason. The deep moss was a reason. So were the ancient trees. So were the children standing in the swash. We can't quit now.
You just heard from two well-known American writers and activists, Kathleen Dean Moore from Oregon State University and Sue Ellen Campbell from Colorado State. They read from their article, Why We Won't Quit the Climate Fight, as published in the Earth Island Journal, January 14, 2019. Now, to the latest science from the polls.
Radio EcoShock.
When it comes to sea level rising by feet or meters, the biggest fear is melting mountains of ice piled up on Antarctica. Recently, NASA scientist Eric Regnault told us those glaciers are melting six times faster now than in the 1950s. In another just published paper, scientists discovered the marriage of two forces making that happen. This could determine the future map of the world as disastrous sea flooding invades farmlands, cities, and whole nations. The science is challenging. It involves a 34-million-year history of Antarctic ice, tiny single-celled animals, carbon dioxide, and the astronomical place of Earth in space, all of that. Fortunately, we have the lead author, Dr. Richard Levy, here to help. Dr. Levy is a paleoclimate scientist and program leader at New Zealand's GNS Science, a government crown corporation, I believe. Levy is a veteran of scientific expeditions to Antarctica, with many papers about the coldest continent on Earth. From Wellington, New Zealand, Richard Levy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks very much for having me.
How many times have you been to Antarctica, and is there a specific base or ship used for your research?
Oh, gosh, I've been to Antarctica now 12 or 13 times, 13 seasons down there. I actually started my career through the United States Antarctic Program, so I was doing my studies, my doctorate degree at the University of Nebraska, and first went down to Antarctica from America, which is sort of strange, really, given that I'm from New Zealand. But yeah, so I've spent quite a bit of time working with the U.S. program, but also spent some time more recently working through the New Zealand Antarctic Program based out of Scott Base. Both of them are on Ross Island. Both of those bases are not too far apart, but run by different countries and run in quite different ways, to be quite honest.
And there is a big stretch in this new paper. Why did you and Stephen Myers from University of Wisconsin-Madison need to connect those tiny creatures, which I'll call forams for short, to the astronomical position of Earth out in space?
Yes, so as you've mentioned, our research focuses on the long-term history of the Antarctic ice sheet. We want to understand when it expanded, when it grew larger than today, and when did it retreat or collapse and get smaller, and fundamentally what caused these changes. We use this knowledge of past ice sheet dynamics to improve computer models that allow us to project future change and determine likely rates and amounts of sea level rise. We're particularly interested in marine-based sectors of the Antarctic ice sheet, areas where the ice sheet sits on the ocean floor, as these regions are vulnerable to increases in ocean heat, and that's something that Eric Regnault's recent study has shown to be true, that these areas of the ice where it sits on the ground below seafloor are particularly susceptible, particularly vulnerable to changes in ocean heat. So our research is really sort of trying to take the longer-term perspective of what Dr. Regnault has observed recently. We've known for a long time that changes in the way our planet orbits the sun affects climate. The shape of our orbit changes from oval or egg-shaped to more circular and back again, and this takes place every 100,000 years, this natural cycle. We also know that the tilt or slant of the axis around which our planet spins every 24 hours changes from steep to less steep, and this happens every 40,000 years. So again, these interacting natural cycles are affecting our climate. So high tilt causes more energy from the sun to directly reach our polar regions, and this has a huge impact on the ice that sits there. Obviously, more solar energy coming in and hitting the ice sheet will cause it to melt. Now, we've known that these changes drive the ice ages, and we've known this for a long time. Research back in the 1800s and into the early 1900s showed us that these changes actually cause our ice ages. But the details regarding exactly how these astronomical shifts affect the ice sheets, they're not really well known at all. So in our study, Stephen Myers at the University of Wisconsin and myself and our co-authors, in our study we examined data from ocean sediment cores. Natural chemicals preserved in the layers of ocean sediment, preserved in the shells of organisms that live in the ocean, tell us about past changes in ocean temperature and ice volume. Now, we noticed there were intervals of time when the ice sheets became much more sensitive to changes in Earth's tilt. These intervals of increased sensitivity to tilt, or what we call obliquity sensitivity, happened during times when large areas of Antarctica's ice sheet first advanced into the ocean. So the first time from all of our geological studies that we see ice sheets stepping into the ocean, expanding into the ocean, then these deep sea chemical records of climate change become much more sensitive to changes in the tilt. So we noticed this relationship. At this time, when we noticed this increased sensitivity, proxy data tell us that atmospheric carbon dioxide levels generally range between 400 and 600 parts per million. This is pretty key because these levels are like those we have today and also very similar to those projected for the next several decades. But these results suggest that changes in ocean heat around Antarctica's margin respond to changing tilt. When the ice is in the ocean, it responds to tilt. It's much more sensitive. These variations in ocean heat have a major impact on Antarctica's marine-based ice sheets. Now, we also noted that the sensitivity to ocean heat change decreased during giant times when CO2 dropped. Now, this is really important. So sensitivity increases when CO2, in the past, when CO2 was above 400, up to 600 parts per million. The sensitivity to ocean heat change decreased during times when CO2 dropped to pre-industrial levels, so dropped sort of down below that 300 parts per million, sea ice grew and expanded across the Southern Ocean. So this is pretty critical. Sea ice appears to act as a buffer or a barrier to ocean dynamics. So right now, today, we have a persistent sea ice, a lot of sea ice around Antarctica, and it seems that this expanded sea ice is sort of buffering or protecting the marine-based portions of Antarctica's ice sheet from heat that would otherwise be driven up onto the continental shelf due to our relatively high tilt that we're at today. Sorry, Alex, I've just carried on talking. You probably have a few questions.
I have lots of questions from that. First of all, it's fantastic science that really you can reach into what may be microscopic organisms buried in the seabed and pull out isotopes of oxygen, basically molecules, and know from that whether ice was growing or shrinking or there at all. Is that what you were doing?
Yeah, that's right. And that's not just our research. That's a huge global effort that's been going on for a long time where people have been looking, scientists have been looking at these marine organisms, the chemistry of these marine organisms and the isotopes captured, which change as ice volume and temperature changes on Earth. So you have this long-term history acquired from deep-sea ocean sediments that tell us something about what the ice sheets were doing and something about what temperature was doing. The challenge with those sorts of records is that they're not direct archives of ice sheet variability. So you actually don't know absolutely for sure that the ice sheets were growing and advancing. You've got a pretty good clue from the changes in chemistry. But what we did was take those records from the deep ocean, run some mathematics, statistical analyses on those records, and we noted changes in patterns through the isotope record. And then we compared that directly with records from the Antarctic margin, which is sort of an area that I've focused most of my research on, myself and colleagues, where we actually see direct records of ice sheet advance and retreat. What we noticed was that during times of high sensitivity to changes in the tilt, they correlated or matched with times where we see evidence for ice sheet advance into the ocean. So that gave us some indication that there must be a connection between times when the ice sheet was in the ocean, connected to the ocean, and an increase in sensitivity to the tilt. So this ocean ice connectivity became apparent because we compared the deep sea records, the planktonic records of climate change, with direct records of ice sheet advance and retreat.
If I go to Wikipedia and look up axial tilt or obliquity, I learn we are halfway through a 41,000-year cycle and we're heading towards decreasing tilt. And according to Wiki, that should mean a cooling phase with more Antarctic ice is in the planet's future. So, you know, a doubter would ask, why is Antarctica melting in what should be a cooling phase of the Earth's tilt?
That's right. So it's not just the tilt that causes the climate to warm and cool. It's also the shape of the orbit, or what we call eccentricity, as well as precession, which is wobble of the Earth's axis like a spinning top. All of those things interact to drive the ice ages. And so if you look at Wikipedia, I mean, it's correct. We are actually, we've passed through a point of high tilt and we're heading back towards an interval of low tilt. And so based on what we've discovered, we should be heading toward a time where changes in the Earth's tilt actually cause the ice sheets or allow the ice sheets to grow, if it was just obliquity driving the climate. But what we also know is that when carbon dioxide levels go above 400 parts per million, then the oceans themselves, the average climate state on Earth, gets to the point where you can no longer maintain extensive marine-based ice sheets. So in this case, carbon dioxide essentially is going to override the cooling effect of the change in the tilt. But what we're suggesting in our research, and what's really critical, is that it also appears that sea ice, or the presence of sea ice, buffers the ice sheets from ocean dynamics, from the warm ocean. When you warm climate, warm the atmosphere, warm the oceans by driving CO2 up, we are likely to lose that sea ice. And because we're still in a relatively high tilt, the astronomical forcing, that climate warming driven by a relatively high tilt, will actually amplify any warming that's happening because of the CO2 increase. And so on human timescales, in terms of what we're doing today to the planet, we're suggesting you'll see an amplification of any warming because of this natural warming due to high and cooling due to low tilt. So because we're in a relatively high tilt, we're going to amplify the warming. Now, you know, if we can wait 10,000 years or so, then the change in tilt to a higher tilt, so that less energy reaches the poles, could actually reduce some of the warming. But that's going to happen on a very, very, very slow, long time frame. And of course, in the meantime, CO2 is high, and we're actually jumping back millions of years to a climate we haven't experienced since 30, 35, potentially 40 million years ago.
Is your 34 million year reconstruction of the history of Antarctic ice sheet, is that new to science, or is it a compilation of earlier work?
Oh, look, I would say it's a compilation of earlier work. We've managed to pull together a whole bunch of records in a way that no one's done that before. We've analyzed those records in a fairly unique way, and we've put essentially two people or a group of people together in a room to look at those data in a different way. So it's sort of a unique way to look at the history, and it's a unique integration of data sets.
When I look through the long history of that polar continent, we make a surprising discovery. There was a mass extinction event in the middle Miocene period, about 14 million years ago, say. But this time the killer was not global heating, as has happened so often in past mass extinctions, but it was a rapid cooling. Can you tell us what happened?
A mass extinction. I have to say, Alex, I'm not too sure what you're talking about.
Ah, well, there's another Wikipedia gem. It talks about the middle Miocene extinction event around 14 million years ago. I'll send you the link and see if I can find out more myself.
I know I've just actually finished reading the book by, I can't remember the name of the author, The Sixth Extinction, won the Pulitzer Prize, I should remember her name, which I found quite fascinating because my colleagues and I are also very interested in drivers of large-scale turnover in the biotic system, in particular the plankton in the ocean. What we do notice is that there in the Southern Ocean, this is another piece of research we've done, in the Southern Ocean, if we look at the diatoms, these marine algae that live and dominate the Southern Ocean today, there are periods where their turnover is much more rapid than at others. So we actually see increased speciation and increased extinction, and it seems to be periodic. And that actually coincides with this mid-Miocene, so-called mid-Miocene extinction event you're talking about, but we actually see it as a turnover pulse. So it's extinction and speciation. Our inference is that turnover was driven by global cooling. As CO2 dropped below a certain threshold, sea ice expanded and caused geographic stress in a way, or ecologic stress on the diatoms. And so cooling can drive these turnover events, but it wasn't a mass extinction in the sense that the Cretaceous, in Cretaceous, loss of the dinosaurs is a mass extinction. It's a perturbation in the biological system that seems to be episodic, periodic, all the way through that sort of, at least from what we can tell, last 20 million years or so.
As you've mentioned, a key factor in this time of human-induced rapid warming is the existence of sea ice around the perimeter of Antarctica. Until 2014, that sea ice seemed pretty healthy, maybe even growing. What is the state of sea ice there now?
Yeah, so it's been a bit of an anomaly, I guess, where people have looked at the Arctic and the observations indicate we're losing Arctic sea ice fairly rapidly, and the counter to that was that the Antarctic sea ice was expanding. And in fact, over the last 2 or 3 years, the satellite observations are showing us that we're rapidly losing sea ice extent in the Antarctic, and I think this year has been the same. Some of my colleagues are sea ice experts, and they're certainly concerned about the current pattern, but of course the time series is relatively short. We've only got 3 or 4 years of data to show that the Antarctic sea ice is decreasing, but certainly from our point of view, from our study, we'd be concerned. If we lose that sea ice, many things will happen, but one of them could be that the warming around the margin, due to the increase in CO2, but also due to the fact that we're at a relatively high tilt or a moderate tilt, will amplify warming up onto the shelf, and that will cause marine-based ice sheets to retreat. So I guess, in a sense, from my perspective, we certainly don't want to see further loss or experience further loss of that sea ice. I don't think it would be good at all.
So a second major piece of science about Antarctica has just been published in January 2019 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Recently, I interviewed the lead author, Eric Rignot, for Radio EcoShock. How does that paper relate to your latest work?
Yeah, well, we're all interested in understanding ice sheet dynamics, I guess, on different timescales, and Dr. Rignot's work is critical for our understanding of what's happening today and over the recent past. Those satellite time series, those satellite data he's analyzing show us that we're losing mass, or that the Earth system is losing ice mass, that Antarctica is losing mass, and it's accelerating. And to be quite frank, that's concerning. I read that piece of work, and it's something that certainly doesn't help me sleep easier at night. Now, what we're showing, again, is that those patterns that Dr. Rignot and his colleagues are observing, if you look over the long term, anytime climate warms due to CO2, due to orbital features, then the oceans tend to warm around Antarctica, and the first thing to start experiencing melt, or the first parts of the ice sheet to start experiencing melt, are those parts that sit in the ocean. They're vulnerable to changes in ocean heat, and that's certainly something that we've observed from the past. We're observing it as it happens today, and most of our computer models that are informed by these past data sets also show that those areas of marine-based ice sheet are highly vulnerable to melt, and other bits of it are going to go first, and that's certainly what we're observing today.
Yeah, I can recall about 15 years ago talking with scientists who basically described Antarctica as an inert slab of ice that would be there for hundreds of thousands of years, and that would be the last to go. But that doesn't seem to be the case now.
No, I think that's the key outcome of all of these studies, is that Antarctica seems to be way more sensitive to climate change than was previously thought. As you say, people have assumed that large chunk of ice sitting down in Antarctica is cold, inert. It feels very little from the rest of the world, but boy, we're learning that that's the opposite. I know when I was doing my studies many years ago for my doctorate, my advisor was saying, look, this ice sheet is way more sensitive, way more vulnerable than many geologists at the time were saying. And it seems that he was onto something. Before him, John Mercer from Ohio State back in the 1950s, early 60s, wrote some papers, one of which was published in Nature, saying that if we continued putting as much CO2 into the atmosphere as we were currently doing back then we'd lose West Antarctica, the marine-based ice sheets of West Antarctica, and that sea level would go up by 3 to 5 meters. And you know, he did this 50, 60 years ago. And again, what we're learning today shows that he was right.
Why isn't Antarctica warming as fast as the Arctic?
Yes, okay. So there's a feature in the Earth system called polar amplification where the polar regions tend to warm much faster than the tropics. You know, average temperature goes up by, let's say, 5 degrees. The tropics may go up by one slightly. They can't really warm that much, but the polar regions can. And the Arctic's certainly experiencing that amplification right now. We're observing it. The Antarctic has sort of delayed, and part of that could be due to the ozone hole, the cooling effect of the ozone hole. We're still really trying to understand polar dynamics, but the expectation is that at some point that amplification will kick up in the Antarctic as well. Certainly around the Antarctic Peninsula, the rates of warming are high, and as high as one might expect. But over the whole of Antarctic, you're right, it hasn't quite amplified as much as the climate models even expect. But who knows, as the ozone hole anneals or heals, maybe we'll get a sudden little kick in the system that we're not really prepared for.
Should we presume there was no ozone hole over Antarctica in the millions of years that you looked at in your records? Is it entirely a man-made phenomenon?
Yeah, I am not the expert. I certainly shouldn't be commenting on that, but you know, if there's a fundamental principle we apply in geology called the present is the key to the past, and my understanding is that the current ozone hole has been driven by human activity, by the CFCs, but I couldn't say for sure whether there was an ozone hole in the past or not. Yeah, so I guess I assume there likely wasn't, because the thing that caused it recently, certainly we weren't around to do it, you know, millions of years ago, that far back in time, but I can't say for sure.
Okay. So you're in New Zealand. Is your country's capital, Wellington, on the list of cities under threat by rising seas if Antarctica really does release its ice?
Absolutely. I actually head up with a colleague program looking at sea level rise around New Zealand, taking the research we're doing in Antarctica, the things we're learning, and applying them, what we call downstream, to New Zealand, but also to the rest of the world. And Wellington certainly is an area that is under threat from sea level rise. In fact, if I get the numbers right, I think a 10-centimeter rise in sea level by 2100, if it was as small as that, increases our risk of flood frequency from a 1 in 100 year to an annual event. It's something like that. So small amounts of sea level rise have a big effect on Wellington, yeah. Something we all need to be thinking about and planning for adapting to.
So what is New Zealand's role in Antarctic research, and does the government fund that?
The government does fund it, yes. No, we're very lucky in New Zealand. Our government invests money to have or supports a base down in Antarctica. So New Zealand has its own base where we can from out in. So New Zealand has its own base out of which we can conduct our research. We've also been fortunate in the recent times, the government's acknowledging the relevance and importance of Antarctica, and has just invested in what they call a science research platform or a science platform. It's been directed by Dr. Nancy Bertler, and it's a real opportunity for us to take some big steps forward in our understanding of the past and future response of the Antarctic ice sheet to climate change. So we're very excited that our government recognises the value and is putting energy and effort into allowing us or enabling us to do research in Antarctica.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
From New Zealand, you're listening to Dr. Richard Levy on Radio EcoShock, and we're talking about new science about the melting of Antarctica. With all our technology, Antarctic exploration is much safer now than in the days of Scott and Amundsen and Shackleton. But when you go there, do you still get a vision of that dangerous nature that's there at the extreme end of the Earth?
Boy, I've thought about this quite a bit. Lying in a tent down in Antarctica during the middle of a storm is certainly a bit unsettling. You sort of hope your tent holds and it's not going to blow away and you go the way that Scott did. But I think I can't compare what we do today to what the early explorers put themselves through. I mean, when I leave New Zealand, I get on an aircraft and, 5.5, maybe 7 hours later, I'm in Antarctica. I've got ModCon gear, high-tech gear that's designed to keep me warm as well as be functional. Now, when Scott and Amundsen and Mawson and some of the heroic figures of previous Antarctic research or early Antarctic research and exploration are concerned, they got on a ship, had to sail off into the distance. 2 years, 3 years later, they might return, and chances are they might not. So from that point of view, I think we're very lucky today that we get to go down there. It's pretty efficient, pretty quick, and we're very well looked after. Having said that, you're out in the wild. Storms come through. Accidents can happen. So you're always having to, consider where you are, work carefully, be safe. Yeah, I mean, just as anywhere else in the world, you might be out in the wilderness, paying attention to your surroundings and just taking care of yourself. Now, of course, in Antarctica, one of the benefits if you're wanting to be safe is there aren't any wild animals that you have to be too concerned about. Where I work in the mountains, there's essentially no life at all. So it's really just the weather and your colleagues doing silly things if they happen to do something silly and you have an accident. They're the two main things you have to worry about. The isolation, if you're in the deep field, sometimes you can be, 2, 3, perhaps a week away from help if the weather doesn't behave itself. So, there are certainly risks, but I think the risks are just so much smaller than back in the day when those, what I might consider fairly crazy individuals sort of booked onto these ships and headed off into the distance.
Crazy but brave. So what's next for you in research?
Boy, it's a good question. I think there's so much we still need to learn and understand about the Antarctic ice sheets. I mean, we're scratching the surface. We're learning a lot. We're certainly able to simulate using computer models the response of the ice sheet to various forcings. But we know that they're far from perfect. There's still major questions about the rates at which the marine-based ice sheets will retreat or by how much. Every time we look at the ice sheet, as Eric Brignot's research and our research shows, we learn more. And everything we learn suggests that the ice sheets, again, are different to what we previously thought. So understanding the long-term history, looking at past intervals of warmth, certainly key. One of the big projects we have on the horizon is an attempt to go much closer to the center or to where the current West Antarctic ice sheet sits on the seafloor, right at what we call the grounding zone, and actually drill a hole right next door to the West Antarctic ice sheet to see whether or not it disappeared during very recent intervals of warmth, intervals of time when climate was similar to those we're trying to achieve through the Paris agreements, if we can mitigate the carbon emissions and keep warming below 2 degrees. Is that enough? Did the West Antarctic ice sheet actually disappear anyway, even if we can keep warming below 2 degrees? We're actually not 100% sure. Data from around the world suggests that at that amount of warming, 1.5 global average, sea levels were 6 to 9 meters higher. So that sort of suggests that the ice sheets disappeared even under Paris targets. Now, whether or not that's true, at the moment we're relying very heavily on models. We want to get data from the center of the ice sheet, right where the action happens, to try to say, yes, it does disappear or did disappear the last time Earth was that warm, or no, it did stick around. So I think that's probably one of the highest priority research areas for us is, what does the ice sheet do under 1.5 to 2 degrees warming scenario? does it stick around, does it disappear? Models suggest it's sensitive, but we want to know for sure. It's understanding what it'll do with respect to all of those people that you mentioned walking around, living around the coastal regions of Earth. I mean, they're really depending on us knowing what the Antarctic ice sheet did the last time it was 1.52 degrees warmer than present. That's the priority.
From Wellington, we've been speaking with Dr. Richard Levy, and he's with New Zealand's GNS Science, and he's the co-author of the paper Antarctic Ice Sheet Sensitivity to Obliquity, Forcing Enhanced Through Ocean Connections, as published in Nature Geoscience 2019. I'll put links to the science in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Richard, thank you for sharing your valuable Down Under time with us.
Alex, thanks very much for taking the time to call. It's been a pleasure.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In the Arctic darkness of February 2018, there was an extreme heat event at the North Pole. The temperature was over 30 degrees Fahrenheit, over 17 degrees C above normal. That is part of the amplified Arctic warming that crashed the summer sea ice and started the great melt of polar glaciers. It changes everything. New science is struggling to explain why it is happening in the Arctic. Researchers from China, the U.S., and Australia worked on a breakthrough paper published last November in the journal Nature Climate Change. Here to explain the surprising findings is the lead author, Dr. Malte Stucker. In a way, Malte is representative of the global nature of climate science these days. After an education in Germany, he got his PhD at the University of Hawaii, following a position as a NOAA Climate and Global Change postdoc fellow. He's now a research professor at the IBS Center for Climate Physics at Pusan National University, Republic of Korea. From Pusan, Korea, Malte Stucker, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you very much for the nice introduction.
Well, you have published papers on the Pacific Ocean and rice in the Philippines, but how did you get drawn into the problem of why the Arctic has become so wildly warm?
Most of my PhD work was actually focused more on the tropics, but when I moved to the University of Washington for my postdoctoral research, I worked together with a lot of polar scientists, and I got really excited about learning more about what's happening in the high latitudes, and that was when this project that we published last November was started.
It was shocking when the summer sea ice crashed in 2007, and now Siberian ports are gearing up for commercial traffic. How strange is it when the whole Arctic changes within a couple of decades?
It is certainly one of the big issues we face in a changing climate. And we've known for long that the Arctic will be one of the regions that will warm fastest in response to increasing greenhouse gases. In a way, it is a situation that's been long in the coming, but the detailed processes, what are most important for these changes in the Arctic, they've been debated for a long time, and our recent paper has helped us to understand a little better the driving forces behind these changes.
Well, yes, before we get to the conclusions of your study, there were several competing theories of why warming in the Arctic is so much greater than in the rest of the world. What was the strongest contender, would you say, before your team's paper came out?
There are many different processes that have been proposed for this amplified warming, and it depends a little bit about what we are talking about. There are certainly changes in the Arctic that are due to internal variability, and due to internal variability in the tropics that might influence how heat is transported into the Arctic. But then there are also local processes that have to do with changes in the sea ice. So once we have melt in sea ice, we can absorb more incoming radiation, so that would, because less is reflected back to space, which was hypothesized as a driving force. So there's been all these ideas around, and they certainly all play a role, but we wanted to really quantify what is most important.
I thought it was mainly ocean waters coming up from the tropics. We've seen heat maps that show hotter waters going from the Gulf Stream into the Arctic and also through the Bering Strait via Alaska. Are you fairly confident that you've ruled out oceans as the agent transferring tropical heat to the Arctic as this primary cause of amplification?
Changes in ocean currents can certainly influence local changes in temperature and sea ice, but it's not really when we talk about the influences from the tropics that's been discussed previously, it's not so much the ocean current that we would discuss, but the fact that if the tropics warm, we change really the global circulation of the atmosphere, and you have transport of heat via the atmosphere into the Arctic region, which is a much more efficient process than changes in the ocean current, which are much usually occurring on much slower timescales.
Well, that makes sense. So as I understand it, for the purpose of this study, your team produced a model that quadruples pre-industrial carbon dioxide. And when you run this experiment with much higher CO2, which may very well happen all too soon, what did you conclude is the main driver of Arctic amplification?
So, as you mentioned, we approached this problem by trying to really isolate the role of local radiative forcing that's coming from changes in the CO2 concentrations. And we noticed when we put increased CO2 concentrations just in the tropics, which is an idealized experiment, we didn't see much of a response in the Arctic region. So when we increase the CO2 concentrations in the subtropics and mid-latitudes, we see some pronounced warming in the Arctic that's coming from heat transport from the mid-latitudes into the Arctic. However, this warming is pretty uniform globally, and there's not this pronounced amplified warming in the Arctic. That means that the Arctic is warming much more than the rest of the globe. So we only get this amplified signal when we prescribe the CO2 concentrations locally in the Arctic, which really points that local processes in the Arctic are the main driving force. And there are several candidates then that we looked at, and we isolated which of these are most important. So we found that this is a process called the lapse rate feedback, which has to do with the vertical structure of the atmosphere that's most important. But then there's other factors, for example, like the sea ice feedback, the albedo feedback, and changes in cloud that also play a role. But these are of secondary importance.
So is the atmosphere in some way creating a kind of lid that's keeping the heat in the Arctic, and that's something that doesn't happen further south?
So, yeah, that's exactly the case. So it's very interesting if you compare the tropics, the tropical atmosphere with the Arctic atmosphere, they're very different. They're very different systems. So in the tropics, we really have these deep clouds, the thunderstorm clouds that go all the way from the surface into the upper troposphere, and they're very effective at bringing heat and moisture from the lower atmosphere all the way up. So what happens is that when you have increasing CO2 concentrations in the tropics, a lot of the warming is actually happening in the upper atmosphere, not in the lower atmosphere. And because it's happening in the upper atmosphere, a lot of that energy can radiate back out into space. But if you compare that with the Arctic region, in the Arctic region, we have something what we call a very strong inversion. What that means is that we have this strong lid on the atmosphere, and air that's at the surface hardly can move up because it's very stable. So what then happens if you warm the Arctic is that that heat is really trapped near the surface, and it still tries to radiate out some of this energy into space, but because it's radiating out from the surface and not the upper atmosphere, much less efficient in doing so. And that process is something what we call this lapse rate feedback.
Well, I have to admit, at first I was a bit confused by the paper. I kind of wandered away from the real point of it, but I was wondering, where does this local carbon dioxide come from? And I know that wasn't really what you were talking about, but there are not many sources in the Arctic other than a few Russian cities and maybe aircraft flyovers. Does it matter where the carbon dioxide comes from, or do we know where it comes from?
Yeah, it can be a bit confusing. I should motivate this paper a little bit better. So, of course, CO2 concentrations in reality are well mixed throughout the atmosphere due to the storms that circle around the Earth. Usually, they mix up all the gases in the atmosphere, so we have very similar concentrations across the globe. So even though you have some sources, maybe in industrialized regions where you emit more CO2, it's going to be well mixed within the atmosphere within a couple of months to a year. In our case, we just wanted to understand actually the dynamics of the coupled system. And to that, we usually have to do more idealized situations. Because in the real world, if we increase in the climate model CO2 everywhere, we see that the Arctic is warming more, but we don't know what is the driving process. So by kind of separating it out from regional changes, we can understand the actual dynamics of the coupled system a bit better. But that's not to say that this is a realistic case. But we have confidence that the mechanisms that we find actually apply to nature, because if we look at the response in these climate models to a global increase in CO2 concentrations, first of all, it looks very similar to what we see happening in nature. So nature is actually showing this Arctic amplification, what the models predict. So this gives us confidence that the models have skill and we can trust them. And then next is, if we separate out these experiments with increasing the greenhouse gases just in certain regions, and we look at the individual responses to these experiments and add them all up, actually the results look the same as the response to the global forcing. So this allows us to decompose these local changes into local processes, which is a very powerful way of understanding the climate system better.
Some Russian scientists and others in the Arctic Methane Emergency Group say methane from the seabed and from thawing permafrost under millions of Arctic ponds are contributing to Arctic heating. Did your study consider the influence of methane?
No. In our study, we only looked at one greenhouse gas, that is CO2. In reality, we have additional players like methane, as you mentioned, that are very important. But the net effect is similar. So both CO2 and methane will trap more heat in the atmosphere and contribute to a warming of the planet. Do the simulation, if we would do the simulation instead with increasing methane, it would give qualitatively the same results, but only the difference would be that methane is an even stronger greenhouse gas, so you would expect an even stronger response. So that's why we should be worried about methane emissions, because the greenhouse gas potential of this gas is even stronger than of CO2.
Based on the processes that you've looked at in this study, do you think the Arctic will continue to warm more than the rest of the world, or is there some kind of limit that it might reach and stabilize?
We are pretty confident. Like, every individual model shows that the Arctic will continue warming stronger than the rest of the planet. All the models will show that Arctic sea ice is increasing at rapid rates. So that's regrettably a future that we are facing unless we reduce emissions. However, on top of this, there's certainly also internal variability of the climate system that can give you certain years where ice would maybe increase again before it drops. So we don't expect these changes that every year is going to be another record hot year. But if you look at changes over 5 years or 10 years, we will certainly see an acceleration of the warming. And that's something the models are very consistent, and we are very confident it will happen unless there are big changes in our emissions.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from South Korea. Our guest is the research scientist Dr. Malte Stucker. He is the lead author of a new study explaining why the Arctic is warming much faster than the rest of the world. Will these study results help us understand how fast Greenland ice could melt?
Certainly, for things like the ice sheets, what's really important is how many days in the summer we stay over the melting temperature. And this accumulated effect of these warm summer days will be one of the major driving forces of melt. So we can certainly use experiments like the one we did to quantify these processes. However, we haven't looked at the specific problem in our experiment yet.
There is a secondary result from your paper which could be controversial. The paper says, quote, "Thus, reducing radiative forcing at the pole may be a more effective policy to minimize Arctic amplification than previously thought." Now, I could read that as saying that solar radiation management, like spraying sulfate aerosols in the Arctic, might be effective because of the local nature of the problem. Is that fair?
That is certainly correct. So if humans decide that they want to go ahead with radiation management, which in my personal opinion think should only be a last resort, because it's not an easy fix. The easier fix is changing our technology into a more carbon-efficient society. But in case humans should decide that they want to employ radiation management, then the question is, where would you put those aerosols to have the biggest net effect. And also it depends on what you want to achieve. So are you concerned about the monsoon regions? Are you concerned about maybe weather in Europe or in Asia? So these are very complex questions that humans have to grapple with. But we just ask this very, very simple question without giving a political judgment that in case you wanted to decrease the temperatures in the Arctic, then having radiation management by spraying aerosols in the Arctic region would be an effective way of decreasing the effect of global warming there, of local warming there. But, yeah, that is not said that it's a good idea to do so.
While we have you here, let's touch on a couple of previous papers you co-authored. For example, many of us are worried about the planet will not be able to feed billions of humans if Earth warms beyond the tolerance of some major food crops. And your August 2018 paper suggested rice may hit that ceiling during this century in the Philippines. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. This was a project I worked together with a biologist from the University of Hawaii and a fellow climate change scientist also at the University of Washington. And we got really interested in this nexus of water, climate, energy, and food. And there's been a lot of interest in the climate community to see how these changes that we are projecting to occur, how will it affect humans on these really fundamental levels. And one of the most fundamental levels is, of course, food security. And one of the crops that is most important worldwide is rice, because it feeds most of Asia, where most of the global population lives. So just to tackle this a bit, to understand how climate variability actually can impact rice production, we decided to use the Philippines as a case study, because it's nice that we have for the Philippines, we have very good rice production data for a couple of decades now. And the Philippines has a lot of different provinces, and we have this data actually on a province level, and we have it on a quarterly, it's reported quarterly. We could really go onto the very small province level and on the small temporal level and see how it relates to climate variability that's occurring in the Pacific. And there we found that your answer really depends a lot on in which province you're located. So that really pointed out to highlight that for local policymakers, they need much better information on how larger climate signals like El Nino really affect their local county or their local province to make informed decisions on how they plan for their rice production in the coming growing season.
And again, most climate science worries about positive feedbacks, the interactions that heat the planet even more. But you participated in a paper in Nature Climate Change that found a negative feedback. Why would a warming Atlantic Ocean lead to a cooling force in the Pacific?
Oh, it's maybe not really correct to say it's a negative feedback per se, because the mechanisms we looked at is more a cyclic phenomena that occurs on timescales of 20 years, but it can easily reverse. So it's not something that will have much impact in the long-term future in response to global warming. However, it can really be important on timescales that are also important for humans for the next 10 years if you want to make policy decisions. And what we found is that one of the reasons that the Earth over the last 20 years has warmed slightly less than our models projected was that the tropical Pacific was in an anomalous cold stage. So something that's been referred to as a negative phase of the interdecadal Pacific Oscillation, which just means there's enhanced upwelling of cold ocean water in that region. And in this study, we've actually found that one of the main reasons the Pacific was enormously cold was that the Atlantic, the tropical Atlantic Ocean, has warmed over this period enormously. So as I mentioned earlier, in the tropics, we can really propagate these signals throughout the atmosphere. So when you have a warming signal in the Atlantic, we heat the atmosphere, we have air moving up, and this changes the wind pattern throughout the globe, especially around the tropics. So what this warming in the Atlantic did, it was it created very different winds in the Pacific Ocean, which changed the structure of the upwelling of cold waters and increased the upwelling. At the same time, it actually led to enhanced sea level rise in the Western Pacific, so impacting a lot of people locally. However, this pattern will reverse as the Pacific will warm more, and also, of course, the ocean waters that will see more influence of the increased radiative forcing due to the increasing CO2 concentrations. So eventually, everything will warm up, but there can be periods of like 10, 20 years that have very distinct patterns that look different from a uniform warming around the globe.
Well, I think this is very important because, yes, things may even out later in the century, but we have to live through the next couple of decades. And I just spoke with Dr. David Victor about their paper saying global warming will happen faster than we think. And one of the factors that they mentioned was a natural warming that might occur in the next 10 to 20 years as part of a cycle, but that will reinforce other warming factors and could really affect everything from food to the rate of sea level rise to ice melting. So, yeah, we got to get through the short term before we get to the long term.
That is true. I completely agree. And there's a lot of effort, actually, within the climate community to try to make this initialized decadal predictions by putting the information we have of that, what's happening in the below the surface in the ocean into climate models to make predictions how this will change the surface warming patterns over the next 10 years. However, this is a field that's still very in its early steps, and there's a lot of challenges to predict the climate system on these the regional patterns of the climate system on these like 10-year timescales. But it's something we should really pay a lot of attention to because you're right, people live locally, and if sea level accelerates locally in one region, it has enormous impact on the local population. The same as if we have a enhanced warming in the Philippines, for example, this will affect rice production in this region enormously. And these things can have ripple effects due to the interconnected society that we live in. So it's not that just rice production affects only the people in that province, but it will affect global markets and it will have ripple effects throughout the world. And that's something we know for a long time, actually, in the climate community. We've been studying El Nino, these cyclic warming events in the Pacific, for a long time. And we see, even though it's a local phenomena that's happening near the equator in the Pacific, we see global impacts in weather and climate, and we see global impacts in markets. We see global impacts in food production. So we have these case studies we can work on to try to understand these impacts of local patterns. But, yeah, much more work has to be done to really inform regional policymakers.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. We have been talking with Dr. Malte Stucker, a research professor at the IBS Center for Climate Physics, Busan National University in the Republic of Korea. You can find links to the science we discussed in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Malte, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
We're out of time, but we won't quit the climate fight. Join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock.